Do you hear something? Something ticking? Listen, a ticking sound. Hear it? Listen very carefully. If your kids are reading the comics, get them to listen with you for a while. Could be the ticking of a time bomb. One of the 1946 models with a wonderful new atomic feature. Notice, please, the streamlined wilderness. Yes, I said wilderness. That was once a city full of people. You ladies will be specially interested in the little children who are still slowly dying. That goes with it. A time bomb, yes, it might be. You do hear it now, don't you? The bomb, I'm holding it in my hands here in this radio studio. The same bomb you hold in your hands as you listen in and tune me off. The bomb you take with you to church or to the golf course. Same thing that ticks away the time as you make plans for the afternoon. Could be a time bomb. Could be the noise the world makes as it winds itself up and gets ready to explode. Oh, that's Orson Welles, you see, on the radio. He's doing another one of those broadcasts about the end of the world, trying to scare the people. Yes, this is Orson Welles. Yes, this is just a broadcast. You can laugh it off as a joke, but you can't laugh off that bomb. Neither can I. It's here to stay. The question is, are we here to stay? Can we live in the same universe with the infernal thing? That bomb, if it only stopped ticking, I could talk to you about pleasanter things. Tell you about the new show that opened on Broadway. Talk about a book or a concert or a prize fight or a party. You know, human interest. But just now I think what interests humans, most humans, is one awful question. When's that thing going to go off? Is there any human way of keeping this planet from skidding off into nowhere and never was? What's the price of peace? The great pacifist, who was a great war president, Woodrow Wilson, said the right is more precious than peace. Well, who's in the right, the left, or is the right right? It's all so mixed up, let's forget about it. I'll play you a hand of gin rummy. Except you can't think about the cards the bomb gets in your way. What price will you pay for peace? You, Russia. What price will you pay? What I must pay, says Russia, no more. I'll pay what I have to pay. I will appease the English further. In Greece and Indonesia. For peace, I will even consent to live in the same world with the British Empire, says Russia. Very nice of you, says Britain. Really, Russia, you do have your gall. It's as though we said we consented to live in the same world with you. You did say so, says literal-minded Russia. You said it in San Francisco, California. And then you took it back in Fulton, Missouri. We will live with you, says liberal-minded Britain. The orator who said we can't spoke from the political dustbin. I beg your pardon, says Missouri, political dustbin. Oh, no, no, not you, Missouri, says liberal-minded Britain. No, no, Missouri. Mr. Churchill has his own portable political dustbin. He carries it around with him wherever he goes and scatters his own private dust in the wind. His Tory friends call that clearing the air. We gave him the merry old heave-ho, remember. We tossed him out in his Tory ear, and by a spanking good majority, Mr. Churchill doesn't speak for us. If he can't get votes, he'll settle for headlines, says Britain. Now let's get back to the main argument. Why don't you, Russia, get out of Iran? Says Russia. Why don't you, Britain, get out of Greece? Says America. Why don't you, Russia, get out of China? Says Russia. Why don't you, America, get out of China? Says America. That's my question. I asked it first, says Russia. Why not answer it first, says America? Get out of China? After you, Ivan. And says Russia with some irony, no, no, America first. America first? F. Ferguson filibuster takes the floor. America first, cries the senator. Who said that? That was the USSR. USSR? Another one of them blame government agencies? No, no, Senator, the Soviet Union. Union, says the senior senator from South somewhere. Union? Them's fighting words, son. And here the senator continues his commentary on white supremacy, the senator's voice harmonizing nicely with an ex-prime minister's, whose thoughts on the God-given superiority of those who speak English mingle in turn with the defense plea of an ex-field marshal of another master race. Why are the Nazis grinning so broadly in their little box? Hitler's hope is coming true, that's why. His enemies are divided. What does it matter who split the atom if the Allies are split? The German bulwark against Bolshevism may be reared again. Oh, yes. There's good news in Nuremberg tonight. America is speaking loudly and carrying a very small stick. We told off Franco and gave Perón a piece of our mind. Sure, Franco and Perón, they were the friends of Hitler. We blurted it right out. Franco and Perón are fascists, so there. Then what? Franco didn't quit, although we asked him to. Perón didn't even blush. He's been too busy winning an election. Our military might in Europe is less than half of what it was last summer. Morale is low, and the army is letting it be known that we aren't ready to do any bluffing, not on big terms. Our bluff might be called. Won't take us a whole year, says the army in the papers today, to regain a position in Europe which would justify that thing called, quote, a strong foreign policy, unquote. Dear Senator Tough Talker, may I ask you a question, sir? Is this the time, then, to persuade Russia that there's no other choice for Russia but to go to war with us? Well, I hear the word appeasement. Am I in favor of appeasing Russia just because we aren't prepared for war? Funny thing. Those who warn us most these days against appeasement were the most guilty of appeasement in Munich, in Manchukuo, and in Madrid. Well, sir, I'm not in favor of going to war, period. Nobody in his right mind can be in favor of going to war unprepared. If the tough talkers are right, if the way to keep the peace is to threaten war, for the love of logic, let's be sure about who is threatened and who is doing the threatening. Just growling, "You better look out, that gun is loaded," isn't very tough talk if you aren't holding the gun. If the gun is pointed at you, the tough talk adds up to a plea for mercy. Let's get the draw on Russia before we shoot it out. Meanwhile, let's shut up. If those who are saying war's got to come mean exactly that, they should be strong and silent. But look at them, they're noisy and weak. Mind, there's no pushover like your flabby cynic. He encourages the battle, but he's the last to fight and the first to fall. Your flabby optimist denies the possibility of war. Your flabby cynic denies the possibility of peace. Unlike the optimist, he can't even be surprised into action. He is prepared for everything except victory. Having surrendered to war, he has already surrendered to the enemy. The cynic must be doubly smart and doubly strong because he has no faith to light his way in the world. Morally blind, he can only prevail by blinding his adversary. Choose the cynic's way, and we must keep that choice a secret. Boast of that choice, and we announce our own defeat. Oh, no. We must lay our traps in the nighttime, and our words must be sugar. Excuse me, please. Excuse the fancy pants phrasing. I've been studying Churchill too hard for the good of this program. Live 1,000 years, of course. I won't hammer out one line like his. The most casual Churchill sentence, you know, rings like a bronze bell, and he seems to be speaking for the ages, even when he's talking through his hat. I've been living with his recent sloganeering because I want to fight it. The high style, of course, can't be imitated, but the theater and thunder of it is contagious, so if I break out in another rash of purple, blame a mighty orator and bear with a freshman editorialist. What I want to say in plain radio American is this. Mr. Winston Churchill has been talking about war. This very public private citizen has been campaigning in America. He's made his holiday as politically significant as the massing of troops at a border. War, he says, is neither imminent nor inevitable, but he says this in a kind of postscript, and he leaves us in a kind of daze. Maybe you think he's opened our eyes and we're just blinking in the sudden glare of reality. Maybe you think he dealt a body blow to the United Nations organization. Whatever you think, I'm pretty sure that World War III doesn't seem any further away since Mr. Churchill came to our shores for a rescue. And the patchings up and the qualifications of the little lecture at the Waldorf are all weighed in, and the substance of Mr. Churchill's message still stands as a plea for immediate Anglo-American alliance. Nothing official, of course. We believe in the UNO. Nothing military, of course. We believe in the UNO. Nothing antagonistic to Russia. Not for a minute. We believe in the UNO. War? We aren't necessarily going to have to go to war. Not war. Perhaps not right away. Perhaps. But war, 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 war. War. Unless the English-speaking world makes the world safe for the English-speaking world. The bright hope being that England and America can scare Russia into temporary submission. But Mr. Churchill has not given his eloquence to the obvious notion that we have no reason to fight Russia at all. And the ex-prime minister's feelings for the unhappy masses in Russia do not seem to extend to the unhappy masses of the British Empire. The great charters drafted and signed on the Atlantic and at San Francisco make suffrage and individual liberty in Russia a concern of the entire world community. But India, it seems, India is none of our business. Most assuredly, says Mr. Churchill, India is none of Russia's business. He well knows that Russia doesn't agree with him. He well knows the words of the Communist Manifesto, quote, "Workers of the world, unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains," unquote. He well knows that Russia has something better than slavery to offer the slave peoples of the British Empire. He does not know or will not offer a competitive way out for that imprisoned people. Making no offer of an alternate solution, Churchill sees no final choice for the world but world war, the destruction of the British Empire, or the destruction of the Soviet Union. In his desperation, he forgets the bomb, forgets that such a contest may well mean the destruction of the living earth. And this is the way of the cynic, the ultimate obscenity. I've said that the cynic must be doubly strong, that to prevail, the cynicism and the strength must be most secret. Well, then why does Churchill declare himself so candidly? Has he gone dotty? Be very sure of it. Churchill is no fool. Be just as sure that he came here not as a friendly prophet with a word of warning, but as a frightened Tory with his back to the wall. Britain can make world war only with the help of America. So Churchill says only Britain and America can make world peace. Now, that sounds almost like sense. But listen carefully. Only Britain and America can make world peace. That's not sense. It's nonsense. And Churchill knows it, so he keeps repeating piously the words UNO, UNO. But UNO means United Nations Organization. It doesn't mean the English-speaking nations united against Russia. Churchill hopes it does, and maybe Stalin thinks it does now. If so, that bomb you heard ticking may be timed for tomorrow, may be keeping its dreadful rendezvous in, shall we say, Turkey. A man called Franklin Roosevelt believed America and Russia could be friends in a friendly world. But Franklin Roosevelt sleeps in a garden in Hyde Park. Churchill paid a visit to that garden last week on his way to dinner with Dewey. The newspapers ran the picture. An arresting tableau it was, the great man at the great man's grave. The co-author of the Atlantic Charter, hatless and heedless. A great deal more dead than the friend he mourned. Miss Churchill, you hear that? Hear it, Mr. Stalin, Mr. Truman, gentlemen in high authority, listen. The bomb. The new model with a special atomic attachment, the time bomb. Ticking the time away, ticking out our last few mortal moments. I'm not trying to scare you. Most of us private citizens are more scared than you are. The men of science, the men who made the bomb, they're the most frightened of all. They know about the new atomic feature, the 1946 improvement. They know what it means. The congressmen are frightened, so they want to give the final power over the atom to the army. You know, in a way, that's just as frightening as the atom bomb itself. The power has to stay with us, the people. Has to grow in us, the people. We can make a garden of this earth of ours, another Eden, or bequeath our children to the pit, to the flames, to unmarked graves in the apathetic silences of burning gas. Now the time allotted to this broadcast has run its course, so I turn off the sound effects. Wish it were as easy as that to stop the thing it stands for. I can't. You can't. But we can. Well, I've been asking those of you who've been interested to listen, to write me your own thoughts, your own opinions, your own ideas, and I've been getting some wonderful letters, and to show my appreciation, I've been sending you a radio for every letter I use on this program. Mrs. M.W. Dirren of Fairfax, California, wrote me asking about World War III. This broadcast was a try at answering some of her questions. A try. My dear Mrs. Dirren, I hope the radio you're getting will bring you news with better answers than I dare hazard today. Until the better answers and the better news, I remain as always obediently yours.
The American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations has just brought you the personal, individual news commentary of Orson Welles. Be sure to listen again over many of these same stations next Sunday at the same time to Orson Welles. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.